Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchuk. On today's show, we'll feature an interview with Maurice Carney from Friends of the Congo to discuss developments in the past year in the Democratic Republic of Congo. We'll also present a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But now, a report about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. This week, the issue of net neutrality has come back to the fore. In the House of Representatives, Edward Markey, a Democrat from Massachusetts, and Chip Pickering, a Republican from Mississippi, introduced the Internet Freedom Preservation Act of 2008. H.R. 5353 would amend the Communications Act to protect the open nature of the Internet and require a series of public hearings nationwide on the future of the Internet. Ben Scott, Policy Director of Free Press, explains.
It signals to the marketplace, to the FCC, and to the rest of the legislators and the public that they represent that an open Internet matters to the federal government and that it will seek to protect consumers' right to speak freely online and engage in commerce in an open marketplace online.
This is an important development for the broad coalition of groups and millions of people who have been fighting to keep the Internet open and accessible without discriminating against content, users, or specific applications.
The bill would, first and foremost, establish net neutrality, the consumer protection of equal access on the Internet, into the foundation of communications law. It is the most forward-looking provision we could ask for out of the Congress directing the FCC to protect an open Internet.
The bill also requires the FCC to study how these open Internet principles should be applied to broadband networks. And, in one of the more novel provisions, the legislation requires the FCC to hold a series of public broadband summits across the country.
This is a critical shift in Internet policymaking. It moves the decision-making outside of Washington, and it opens the door and shines sunlight on what is often a backroom, lobbyists-only deal-making session that typifies telecommunications policy in the District of Columbia.
Open Internet activists are hoping to get 100 sponsors to sign on to the bill in the next 100 days. For more information about the Internet Freedom Preservation Act and contacting your members of Congress, go to savetheinternet.com.
And now, here's a Media Minutes Fast Fact.
The Bush administration released a new report boasting about its success in fostering policies for widespread broadband Internet adoption in America. But a survey from the Pew Internet and American Life Project found that roughly half of all Americans don't have broadband at home. And broadband growth in the United States is actually slowing, down 15% from last year's pace.
Despite $11 million spent on lobbying efforts, last year the Tennessee legislature rejected a statewide franchising bill that would have stripped authority to negotiate cable and broadband agreements away from cities and towns. The bill was widely criticized for its lack of build-out requirements, few consumer protections, and no financial support for public, educational, and government channels. Now lawmakers, once again backed by AT&T, are gearing up to reintroduce the bill. But this year, they have a new champion in House Speaker Jimmy Nafee. Nafee, who didn't actively support last year's bill, reportedly has been holding private negotiations between AT&T and the cable industry to work on compromise legislation. What changed? Last year, Nafee's wife, Betty Anderson, known as Tennessee's most powerful lobbyist, worked for the cable industry, which opposed the bill. This year, she signed on as a consultant for AT&T. NAFI says there's no conflict of interest and that the negotiation process has been transparent, and he wants to be sure that, quote, Tennesseans are getting what they're requesting. But public interest groups and community media advocates have not been invited to the meetings, and neither has the press. The industry claims that statewide franchising will result in lower prices, but the evidence is thin. For instance, in Texas, which has had a statewide franchising law since 2005, video prices have not decreased anywhere near the 25% to 30% promised by the phone companies. In fact, nearly every video provider in Texas, including AT&T and Verizon, has raised its prices in the past 2 years. The Tennessee statewide video franchising bill has yet to be put on the legislative calendar. For more information about statewide franchising, go to saveaccess.org or freepress.net/statetracker. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
It is a shameful indictment of American political culture that even though the United Nations headquarters is physically located in the U.S. on the east side of Manhattan Island, it might as well be in Sri Lanka or New Delhi when it comes to U.S. media attention. What the UN does is considered important news in most of the world, especially in the developing and formerly colonized world. But American media, much of it headquartered within walking distance of the United Nations, most often behaves as if the world body doesn't exist. Racism and imperial chauvinism are at the root of thinly veiled U.S. disdain for the United Nations. The UN was founded in 1945 as a creature of the winners of World War II. The cards were stacked in the United States' favor back then, with America and its ideological allies arrayed against the Soviet Union in the UN Security Council, and much of the planet still under European colonial rule. With decolonization in Africa, Asia, and the Caribbean, the UN became a much more non-white environment. Membership now includes nearly 200 countries. Apparently, that's way too much color for the white American comfort zone. The American delegation to the UN will be even more discomforted on February 21st and 22nd, when the U.S. will be taken to task on its own domestic race relations. Many Americans don't know or don't care that international treaties to which the U.S. is a part have the force of law within the United States. One of those treaties is the International Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, which was adopted by the U.S. in 1994. Yet this is only the second year that Washington has even bothered to issue a report to the U.N. on the state of race relations in the U.S., a report that the U.S. Human Rights Network calls a whitewash. The Human Rights Network is a coalition of 250 activist groups across the nation. They charge the Bush administration with being utterly out of touch with the reality of racial discrimination in America. Washington fails to even acknowledge the disparate racial impact on people of color of Hurricane Katrina. Police brutality against people of color is totally neglected in the official American report, which also sidesteps the question of why 60% of U.S. prison inmates are non-white. Muslims and people of Arab descent are targeted for draconian roundups and other pressures in violation of the spirit and letter of the treaty, while Native Americans continue to suffer under the legacy of colonialism and racial discrimination in the U.S. Many Americans conveniently forget, or just don't give a damn, that racial discrimination violates a host of international laws. It is fitting that the U.S. will be confronted with many of these violations on Thursday, February 21st, the 43rd anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X. It was Malcolm who insisted that what were then called civil rights were really human rights to which all peoples of the world were entitled. In this, he picked up the banner waved by Paul Robeson and other African Americans of the left in the late 1940s, with their petition charging the United States with genocide against black Americans. Malcolm's voice infused the Black Freedom Movement with an internationalist perspective. He called for African Americans to stand up as citizens of the world rather than act like an isolated minority begging favors from a hostile domestic majority. Malcolm's legacy and Paul Robeson's legacy still challenges African Americans to grow up, to transcend Jim Crow politics, and to finally take their places on the liberation side of the world stage. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
This year marks the fifth anniversary of the start of the Iraq War, and Chicagoans will once again take to the streets in protest. On Wednesday, March 19th at 6 p.m., join a rally in Federal Plaza, downtown Chicago, and march to the Gold Coast. On Thursday, March 20th, take part in a full day of creative actions, followed by a convergence at 5 p.m. in Federal Plaza. To learn more, visit chicagomassaction.org or call 773-536-0098. See you in the streets.
The New World Resource Center presents We Are Many, Inquiries into Chicago Activism. It's a series of presentations highlighting the struggles and successes of Chicago area activists and organizers looking to connect the political to the everyday. The series is held every second Thursday at 7 p.m. at 1300 Northwestern Avenue in Chicago. For more information, visit myspace.com/NWRC for the New World Resource Center.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stupinchik. We now feature an interview with Maurice Carney from Friends of the Congo to discuss developments in the past year in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The following interview was recorded on Saturday, March 1st, 2008. We are on the phone with Maurice Carney. Maurice Carney is an organizer with the group Friends of the Congo, online at friendsofthecongo.org, a group which works to bring about peaceful and lasting change in the Democratic Republic of Congo, formerly the African country formerly known as Zaire. And Maurice Carney is joining us on the phone from, you're in Washington, D.C.?
Yes, that's correct.
And Maurice Carney, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being with you today.
And in fact, I should say welcome back to the show. We had you on last year, in February 2007, to talk about the situation in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and also with regards to what's happened since that interview. In particular, there's a since then, there's been a peace agreement of sorts. Could you begin by talking about this?
Yes, certainly. Even though the country had its elections in 2006, the conflict, which was resolved supposedly in 2003, was still simmering in the east of the country, primarily in the provinces of North and South Kivu. And in the fall of 2007, it became the situation became uncontrollable. So the international community, the United States in particular, neighboring countries stepped in to bring about a peace agreement between the government and a rebel group headed up by rebel leader Laurent Nkuna. And that peace accord was signed. However, unfortunately, many Congolese and myself as well feel that there are certain fundamental flaws in the agreement. In fact, since the signing of the agreement, it's been broken by the rebel groups. And there are a few key flaws with the agreement. One, we felt that Rwanda should have been more implicated, because you wouldn't have the situation in the east of the country without Rwanda being involved. They're the primary supporter of the rebel group, Laurent Nkuna's rebel group in the east of the country. Two, more pressure could have been put on Rwanda itself in terms of stopping the support of rebel groups, and also opening up political space in its country, because the rebel groups are in the east of the country ostensibly to protect the Tutsi, because of the Hutus who are in the east of on the Congo. They've been there since the 1994 genocide, when they fled Rwanda to escape the oncoming forces led by Paul Kagame to stop the genocide in Rwanda.
When you had said that this peace accord, I thought it was going to be lasting, but it didn't seem like it would be. Why has it been broken?
Well, it's been broken because it was poorly formed in the first place. there are a number of people who believe that Nkunda's group really not acting in good faith, in that they're backed up by the Rwandan government, and there's a belief that they have designs on the mineral wealth on the east of the country, and they're using the protection of the Tutsis as a pretext for controlling and having controlling influence in the east of the country, particularly control over the tin mines and the coltan mines and the diamond mines, diamond and gold mines that are found in the wealthy, naturally wealthy part of the Congo.
So what would you foresee as far as the hopes for brokering perhaps a new peace accord? Do you expect this new outburst of violence to continue?
Well, I was just talking with some Congolese, a few Congolese this morning, and we were suggesting that if, in fact, the international community was to put pressure on Rwanda and say to stop supporting rebel groups, that is to say, stop sending military support or financial support to the rebel groups in the east, that would go a long way to bringing an end to the situation. The government had the United Nations had put an embargo on military equipment and weapons going into the east of the country. That's another step in the right direction. But the key, without a doubt, to bringing peace to the east of the country is pressure on Rwanda and the Rwandan government, and pressure on Rwanda to stop supporting rebel groups in the east of the country.
How has the United States government been reacting or acting, if at all, in this entire state of affairs?
Well, the U.S. government has been deeply implicated. They provided funding for the peace accord. They had a special envoy in the area. However, they've been remarkably and unfortunately reluctant to bring the pressure to bear that is needed on the Rwandan government. In fact, Rwanda hasn't even been a part of the discussion as far as the United States is concerned. But if you talk to any Congolese in the North Kivu or South Kivu, they'll tell you all day that the steps that are needed to stop the conflict is found in Kigali, in Rwanda, and that's where the pressure needs to be put.
What would you say as far as media coverage of this entire state of affairs? It would seem that since this is a pretty serious, not only circumstance with regards to the peace accords that were signed and now the recent outburst of violence, that I really, to be honest, haven't seen very much, if at all, of this situation in most of the major American media. Would you agree? What's your assessment?
Well, the Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders.
Mm-hmm.
Borders, stated that the Congo story overall is one of the 10 least covered stories in the world. And this is in the face of the United Nations saying that the Congo conflict has been the deadliest conflict in the world since World War II. So there's no doubt that there's been a tremendous silence around the situation in the Congo. And we argue, Friends of the Congo argue, that one of the key reasons is because of the vested corporate interests in the copper and the diamonds and the gold and the tin and the cobalt. That's in the Congo. You have major American corporations have an interest there, many of whom have been identified by the United Nations in four studies that it did in 2001 to 2003 as having illegally exploited the natural wealth of the Congo. So that, in part, in any case, explains why there's a silence around the Congo.
Along the lines of this entire sordid state of affairs, there's also been a study that's been released in the past year by the International Rescue Committee. Could you tell us a little bit more about this?
Certainly. It's the second study that was released by the International Rescue Committee. And the main points in the study indicate that at least 5.4 million people have died since 1998 as a result of the conflict and conflict-related causes. Most of the deaths come about because of malnutrition, pneumonia, diarrhea, conflict-related causes. That is to say, when people have been driven off their land or had to leave their villages as a result of marauding rebel groups, they were driven into the bush, and it's been hard for people to survive. So that that basically explains the large number of deaths. If you look a little deeper into the study, they state that up to 50%, half of the 5.4 million dead, are children who are 5 years old or younger. So here you have 2.7 million children dying since 1998. Again, we go back to that silence issue, and there is no outcry, not even from, you know, women's groups or children's groups, irrespective of where they are in the world. You have this deafening silence. So even the study even goes on to say that 45,000 people continue to die each month in spite of the fact that there's been peace accords and government's been elected. So the situation is very severe, and there's an enormous amount of suffering that is taking place among the Congolese people.
Do you know when the study was released?
The study was released in January of this year, about the third week of January.
And
of 2008.
Right. Given that there hasn't been a whole lot of time since the release of the study, and we're recording this on March 1st, 2008, what has there been any response from local, from governments, from the United Nations, from non-governmental organizations, from anyone in the wake of this study?
Well, you get a tremendous amount of response even before the study from the United Nations, in particular. Antonio Guterres, the UNCHR, the High Chief for Commissioner for Refugees, had given an interview to the Financial Times in early January before the report came out, and he was lamenting how the global community had been not only silent but hadn't provided the necessary support for the people of the Congo. He went further to explain how the international multilateral institutions, such as the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, were playing a negative role, a role that caused the perpetuation of the violence in the Congo, in that they were putting financial restrictions on the Congolese government such that the government couldn't properly finance its military force. And as a result of that, the military force, not getting the necessary funding it needed, they would feast on the population, which was exacerbating the violence in the Congo. He also went on to say that we must not forget that the international community has systematically looted the Congo. That is to say, the multinational corporations have been in the Congo and looting it systematically, which has also fueled the conflict in the Congo, because you have rebel groups who are controlling certain mineral-rich areas, and they sell their the minerals that they mine to foreign corporations. So you do have people speaking out, and that's what's so remarkable. You have Senator Sam Brownback, for example, Republican, who has spoken out about the situation and how the coltan mining that has taken place in the Congo is having a deleterious effect on the population. He said, you know, each American, almost every American, has a device in which coltan is found, and how this is directly, the coltan and the processing of, the mining and processing of it is directly affecting the conflict in the Congo. You have Senator Obama, who has spoken out. He said, if Africa is to achieve its promise, the problems, resolving the problems in the Congo are critical to this. So it's remarkable that you have these people speaking out, but yet there doesn't seem to be much action to back it up.
Now, I can understand why, you know, corporations and perhaps the corporate media may not want to, you know, do something or give coverage to this entire situation in the Congo because of the vested economic interest that you had mentioned. But it kind of strikes me that groups that organizations or concerned citizens that you figure would don't have to worry about that and would want to help out? Women's rights groups, children's rights groups, groups that work regarding issues of economic justice. You'd figure that they would want to enter the fray, but my impression I'm gathering is that they don't. Is this correct? And if so, why do you think that's the case?
Well, they don't in large part, and you named the right groups, because if your interest is human rights, the Congo has got to be talked about because of the scale of human rights violations in the country. If your advocacy issue is the environment, Congo is a part of the second largest rainforest in the world, and the rainforest is central to fighting, dealing with climate change. If you're a labor group, child labor abounds in the Congo, and the East in particular, where children are going crawling on their bellies in mines 150 to 100 feet deep to get tin and coltan out. Animal rights groups, you know, Congo has species of gorilla that are endangered, and as the conflict is making it even worse for them. So you have a broad coalition of folks that could be interested in the Congo. However, there's several reasons why this is not occurring. One, not enough information is getting out, in spite of the fact that Friends of the Congo and a number of other groups are trying to get information out. There needs to be mass media distribution of information, and that's not happening. And part of the reason why that's not happening is that people who are responsible for going in and covering the story and getting to the root of it, they come under threat. Even the United Nations, when it did its study from 2001 to 2004, the people who were impaneled by the United Nations to do their study, to study the illegal exploitation of mineral wealth in the Congo, they came under death threats. So you have a combination of things. The reporters not really getting to the matter and telling the truth and providing a context in which the conflict, proper context, historical context in which the conflict can be discussed so that the general population can understand. And also the question of people being threatened with their lives for going out and telling what's really going on in the Congo.
I wonder if perhaps a comparison, at least as far as some kind of activism involved, might be drawn with what had happened in Darfur, where this show is being broadcast on the radio station of the University of Chicago. And at the University of Chicago, for a number of years, you had students' rights groups and human rights groups who were working very actively pressuring the university to divest in companies that had invested in the Sudan, where the genocide in Darfur was taking place. And you would also see like famous celebrities like George Clooney, who were also taking a stand, lobbying at the United Nations, working on that issue as well, trying to make that. I wonder if that might be a template that could be used with regards to the situation in the Congo to help what's going on there. Would you agree? What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. It's a template that that can be used. Remember, the fundamental premise on which the people have been mobilized around Darfur comes out of the Declaration of Human Rights, and that's the responsibility to protect the vulnerable. And nowhere else in the world does it apply like it does in the Congo. Remember, in Darfur you have a quarter of a million people dead, at least. In the Congo we're talking about 5.4 million over 10 years. So surely if you're talking about responsibility to protect, then you would apply that same principle to the Congo as is applied to Darfur. But there are some fundamental differences and historical occurrences that make Darfur more well-known throughout the world than the Congo. And you have a constituency that's developed around Darfur. For example, you have in the White House, an evangelical in George Bush. And the evangelicals have been involved in Sudan for a number of years. You have the evangelicals siding with the southern Sudanese Christians and so-called animists against the northern Muslim or Arab. And this has transferred over to Darfur, where the conflict has been presented, although not accurately, as an Arab Muslim against an African population. And this has brought in the evangelicals, of course, and then you also have the Jewish groups who have come in under the guise of preventing genocide. So you have those two strong groups who have strong connections to the president in the White House and have access to a great deal financial resources to the point where the Save Darfur groups and other groups have a $15 million a year budget. So with that kind of firepower, they're able to popularize the Darfur conflict and get support from not only from the United States but around the world. And then when you add to that, the enemy is the Sudanese government and the Chinese. You know, then you also get the that distant enemy that can be where you can mobilize people against it. But if you are dealing with the Congo, where the corporate interests are not necessarily the Chinese, at least not at this stage, but are institutions or corporations such as Cabot or out of Boston, Massachusetts, or OM Group out of Cleveland, Ohio, or Freeport-McMoRan out of Arizona. If these groups are on our home soil, it's a lot harder to mobilize against them.
Last question. You had mentioned that Senator Barack Obama, who's actually from Chicago and, in fact, actually taught at the University of Chicago, had spoken out with regards to the situation involving Kivu and the Congo. Should Barack Obama win the Democratic nomination for president, and should he be elected president in 2008, would you foresee that that might help to open an opportunity for positive constructive action regarding the Congo?
It should open up an opportunity. However, it's going to take the efforts of people in your listening audience and people of goodwill throughout the United States to bring the whole question of the Congo to Mr. Obama in a way that it hasn't been brought before. Because if you follow the debates that have been taking place so far, there hasn't been any mention of the Congo and what's taken place there. There's been some mention of Darfur, but not the Congo. And if, as Mr. Obama said himself, that Congo is critical to the future of Africa, certainly the Congo ought to be discussed. Sensible policies ought to be formed around the Congo, policies that result in keeping the Congo's neighbors out of the Congo, policies that result in the Congo itself controlling its own mineral resources and utilizing it for the benefit of the Congolese people. I believe that pressure can be brought to bear on Mr. Obama, even though he may already be inclined to do something about the Congo. He's going to have a lot of corporate interests lobbying him to keep things the way they are. So it'll be up to each and every one of us, the individuals that are out there, ordinary people, to bring this to Mr. Obama's attention in a way that would make him work in the interest of the Congolese people and not in the interest of the corporations that are benefiting from Congo's wealth.
We've been speaking with Maurice Carney, who is an organizer with the group Friends of the Congo, online at friendsofthecongo.org. That's a group that works to bring about peaceful and lasting change in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the country in Africa formerly known as Zaire. Maurice Carney, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. And hopefully a year from now, when we come back, we can tell you that there's been tremendous progress made and the Congolese people are on a path to peace and justice in their land.
Let's hope so.
That was an interview with Maurice Carney from Friends of the Congo, recorded on March 1st, 2008. Again, the website of Friends of the Congo is friendsofthecongo.org. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.